From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. If you don't know Nikki Nakayama, you should. She's the chef of Ennaka and Palms, a restaurant that specializes in perhaps the highest form of Japanese cuisine, kaiseki.
The first time I had kaiseki was in Japan at my relative's inn, and it's a formal way of dining for Japanese cuisine. It's made up of different courses that follow a certain sequence defined by the seasonal ingredients and the cooking methods used to highlight its flavors.
Helen Rosner of The New Yorker recently called Ennaka the most prominent kaiseki restaurant in America. Nakayama and her wife and partner, Carol Ida, have carved out a totally unique path in the world of kaiseki, a tradition where female chefs have historically been all but absent. For years, these women have been defying convention, and now the accolades are pouring in. Try getting a reservation and you'll see what I mean. I'm catching up with Nikki and Carol now. Hello, ladies.
Hi.
Nikki, can you start by giving us a refresher on the format of kaiseki? Is there a certain number of dishes, or is that left up to the chef?
It's mostly left up to the chef. Usually, it's about 7 courses at the minimum, and it can go up to anywhere between 7 to 17 courses. And it's usually an odd number, because Japanese people have a thinking where the odd number is a more fortunate number to work with.
And where did it come from? How did it develop? Was it a court cuisine?
It originally started in the Buddhist monasteries, and it's based off of a cuisine that was served during tea ceremony. And in its original form, it's a much more formal, much more subdued type of enjoyment because it's just something to stave off the bitterness of tea. So it was a little bit of a stuffy kind of experience. And in time, it evolved into something that was a lot more elaborate and a lot more celebratory. So even in its writing, there are 2 different types of writing to describe kaiseki.
What do you mean?
One is written in kanji as a stone to the chest, which is said to have alleviated the hunger that the monks felt from fasting. And another writing is a seated ceremony. So there are 2 different writings pronounced the same way, but 2 very different styles of kaiseki.
Wow, how interesting. And Carol, what was your first exposure? Was it Ennaka?
I've had kaiseki in Japan prior to Ennaka, but it was when I was much younger, traveling with family and staying at ryokans. So that's when they would bring the actual courses to your room. And it was a much more relaxed, still very elaborate, but very relaxed kind of experience the first time I had it. And I was probably in my teens. So I don't think, you know, it fully translated. And especially then, I don't think my parents took us to the most fanciest ryokans. It was much more family style. So Ennaka was probably my first, I guess, more high-end experience of kaiseki. So it was like nothing I had experienced before.
Did you start your relationship with Nikki as an eater at Ennaka?
No, we actually met online. And she was kind enough to invite me to come eat. And that was just quite an experience. I was very blown away my first time eating there.
Wow. Good on for online dating.
I was very nervous to have her. I was kind of like running all over the kitchen, not knowing what was going on. And everybody was trying to follow my lead. And I was like, don't touch any of this food. I'm serving it to one of my friends.
You know, it's interesting. Over the past couple of weeks, I've been thinking about you. I was interviewed for the New Yorker piece, and I was talking to a friend of mine, a chef that we both know, and he was talking to me about how kaiseki in Japan is perceived as such a male enterprise, such a male form, which, you know, what do I know? I had no idea that's how it was perceived. Talk to me about that. Like, why is it seen as so male? Because that kind of sets the stage for you taking on this expression and kind of pushing back a bit.
Well, Carol and I have thought about this a lot. I think in general, everything in Japan is male-oriented, especially in terms of professional careers. I was saying how there's such a reverence for tradition in Japan, that tradition in Japan is such, it's held at such a high regard that there's this constant effort to preserve it and preserve it and preserve it. And then when you really think about tradition in Japan, it really only benefits more the men in the society versus the female. When I decided to do kaiseki yet and naka, there was this feeling of wanting to preserve tradition, but yet wanting to move the needle a bit. So there was never an intention to do traditional kaiseki. It was always, well, I love kaiseki because the philosophy about it is so much about gratitude and being grateful and celebrating nature and all these wonderful things. And yet there's this part of it where if you're not a man, you're not allowed to go near it or touch it or be, you know, it's kind of like challenging what has been the tradition for many, many, many years.
I find it so odd because when I think about nature and seasonality, historically, I think about goddesses and I think about women's role in being an intermediary for nature. Is there something about the structure of the courses or how the food is actually put together that within the culture is read as male?
I don't see that at all. I feel that there's this belief in Japanese culture that women don't have the ability to meet the standards or the technical abilities that a man can. And I think a lot of it comes down to women not having been given the opportunity to learn or to try. I think it's kind of just has always been a thing where women are expected to play a certain role within the family and to take care of the family, where men go out and work and bring home, you know, the financial support. Yes.
Carol, when you decided to step into the kitchen, when the two of you made that decision to support Nikki and also just get your hands in, was part of the desire to do that beyond the personal connection, wanting to be like a double female kaiseki experience, like wanting to also support the gender issues that some people were trying to lay on her?
No, it wasn't so much a conscious decision in that kind of deeper way. It was really, she was in an emergency situation where her longtime sous chef that she had worked through varying restaurants in the past with suddenly didn't show up. And, you know, this is while we were still dating, and I could feel the panic in her text when she had mentioned it to me. And, you know, just timing-wise, I was able to free myself up at night to come and help. And I was really nervous to even offer. And, you know, obviously it's very early stages of dating. So you kind of think, especially with my background, with my family having been involved in the restaurant business and seeing how hard it was between my parents, it was not something that I took lightly, but at the same time, I could relate to that stress that she was undergoing and just felt like if there's anything, even if I can help make dashi or, you know, wash the rice or whatever, like every little bit helps in a small kitchen like ours or like that she had at that time. So it was more out of that desire to help relieve some of that stress than thinking it was going to be a long-term thing or, you know, thinking much further beyond that.
That's kind of a relationship forged in fire.
Yes.
So who besides yourselves is doing kaiseki in the U.S.?
I think there's a good amount of people now exploring kaiseki, especially the idea or the concept of kaiseki. I know there's a new one in New York called ODO, I think it's pronounced ODO, and the chef there is working with local ingredients as well and implementing that in his menu. Just in LA in general, there are a few chefs doing kaiseki, even with Shunji, his sushi restaurant. He does a format of kaiseki. It's not a formal format, but it's along the lines. And even with omakase styles, they all follow some styles of kaiseki service in terms of what dishes they would serve in progression. But as far as a very formal one, I suppose the newest one would be Hayato in downtown. And his is a couple style where he stands in front of the guests and serves the food to the guests. And they're all really wonderful in their own right. And I think a lot of them are more traditional than what we do. But it's very interesting to see this influx of people bringing kaiseki more to the forefront. and I think it's a wonderful thing.
So you have been the standard bearer.
I'm so afraid to take any stance on things like that. I feel that wanting to do kaiseki was a decision that came from my personal experience of having enjoyed it so thoroughly. And I mean, we have this conversation a lot, but that experience for me unfolded like a gift. It continued and continued and opened this little, you know, porcelain thing or eat from this little plate. And it was just this constant revelation. And it was so fun and exciting. And that was the main reason why, in the back of my mind, I thought, one day I want to do something like this. Because having it bring so much joy to me, it would be so wonderful to be able to translate that and provide that kind of experience for others as well.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for coming. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you so much for having us.
I've been speaking with Nikki Nakayama and Carol Ida, the women behind Ennaka. To read Helen Rosner's story in The New Yorker, go to kcrw.com/goodfood. And be sure and watch The Chef's Table Season 1 episode about Nikki and Carol if you haven't already. After the break, we shift our focus to a tragic episode in U.S. history, the Japanese-American internment camps. We're hearing stories of survivors who are tasked with keeping those memories alive. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman.
These thousands of Japanese and Japanese Americans were moved forcibly across the American West in Utah and Arizona, and they were living in repurposed barracks and old fairgrounds in horse stables, really terrible conditions, and some of them were there for up to 4 years.
I've been talking with journalist Bridget Reed. In a recent photo essay for Vogue, she spoke with women survivors of the Japanese internment, as well as their descendants who have become custodians of family memory. A number of them have deep roots in California agriculture and still work the land. Before you tell us how you were introduced to these multi-generational women, give us a brief history of FDR's executive order, which called for some 120,000 people to be sent to, quote, relocation centers in the 1940s.
Sure. In response to Pearl Harbor in 1942, the American government was considering how to preempt a possible full-scale attack on American soil by the Japanese, and public opinion quickly turned against Japanese migrants already living on the West Coast. And after a lot of mounting pressure, FDR signed this executive order to create exclusion zones. And these were places all along the West Coast, but also on the East Coast, in which the military could decide who was deemed a threat and who had to leave their homes. It covered both non-citizens and citizens. On the West Coast, it included the entire state of California. So anyone with at least 1/16th of Japanese ancestry was required to leave. And it was obviously racially motivated because Germans and Italian American citizens were not rounded up. Only Japanese Americans and Japanese migrants were. So that's kind of the very bullet point version of a really complicated part of World War II.
Growing up in Southern California in the 50s, I was really aware of families that had an agricultural link to California. How vital were Japanese American farms in California's Central Valley to America's crops during this period?
The answer is very. Japanese immigrants had been coming to the West Coast and elsewhere in the United States since the late 19th century. They found huge success, especially in the Central Valley. They had high labor, high yield farming styles, compared to white American farmers who were using resource-intensive, low-yield styles. But really, Japanese farmers used different techniques on different soil, and they got great results. They were able to corner the market on what are called truck crops. So at the same time that they were starting their farms and small businesses, the U.S. Was expanding how many of these products were being shipped around the country. And strawberry, celery, peppers, peaches, I mean, they were simply dominated by Japanese and Japanese-American farmers. I think as of 1940, some 45% of employed Japanese-Americans on the West Coast were farmers. And in 1942, the crops they produced were valued at $40 million. They contributed hugely to that part of the economy and to feeding the whole country. And this was a huge incentive for agribusiness controlled by white farmers and white legislators to eliminate that competition. And they were open about it.
What happened to this land once these farms were disrupted and the farmers were ripped away? Were the farms successful for the white people who took them over?
The answer is no, simply because the loss of all the labor and direction from the owners and the families that worked on the farms was huge. So even if white farmers or non-Asian farmers took over, there was much more loss associated with the relocation than there was with anybody who was able to sort of take over and keep it viable. Around 200,000 acres were confiscated or sold under duress. And three quarters of farmers that came back after incarceration had no farm to return to.
Let's talk about some of the stories that you highlight. I would love to start with Robin Cota of Cota Farms. She's so beloved here in Southern California.
The Cota family story is just one of really remarkable perseverance. The story of her grandfather, Keisuburo Cota, he found success in a number of other industries before turning to rice farming. When he wanted to look for land to buy for cultivating rice, he couldn't buy land because no one would sell it to him, and he had to go as far south as any, you know, rice grower had ever gone in the San Joaquin Valley, and that's where the farm still is today. I mean, he fought huge obstacles, including these racist restrictive laws that meant that Japanese migrants could not buy land in their own name, so often they were buying land in their children's names. He's an example of someone that when the incarceration mandate came down, he actually wanted to shut down his farm and wasn't allowed by the government. Per Robin, it had something to do with the farm producing cotton for the war effort. Very rightly, he could not run the farm from a prison in Colorado, and it was power of attorney was given to non-Asian neighbors who left the farm essentially to ruin, including equipment, including their homes. And Keisuburo came back and set up shop, Robin says, right down the road. You can still see the derelict buildings from current Cota Farm headquarters. And that's really the legacy that they've inherited and that they're continuing. And the fact that they commit to this heirloom rice, which is a beautiful memory of their grandfather, even though it's really costly to produce and the demand is not what it once was for this specific type of Japanese rice. But it's important to them to keep it in the family. And it's just an incredible legacy that you can actually eat.
Many of us in the California food community know about the Masumoto farm. Mas Masumoto has written so eloquently about the farming life. You have this quote from Makiko Masumoto from her grandfather, who was drafted into World War II while incarcerated. I'm wondering if you could read that quote.
Sure. Losing your oldest brother while fighting a war in Europe, while knowing your family was in prison, and then choosing to make a life loving the land and feeding America, I cannot forget that my family was not wanted.
It's just so complicated that this country imprisoned people and then expected them to fight for them.
It is exactly as you say, it's really complicated because you don't want to sort of overstate the romanticism of of what it means for someone like Nikiko to be on her grandparents' land, but you also don't want to emphasize only suffering. And that's something that survivors and descendants alike talk about is it's not one or the other.
There's this really interesting place outside of Sacramento, the Wakamatsu Tien Silk Farm. Can you tell us about it, what role it had in the fabric of Japanese farming in California?
Yeah, Wakamatsu is sort of an enchanted place. It is in the Gold Hill region outside Sacramento, this incredibly fertile area. So it was founded by a group of samurai farmers and craftsmen who left Japan and founded this colony where they were planting mulberry trees and tea plants, rice, fruit trees, and they were all going to thrive in this beautiful Sacramento sort of hillside. And they only lasted for 2 years. There was a massive drought. We actually don't know what happened to the majority of the colonists, and the land was taken over by a white family who lived there until it became a conservancy. And for the past few decades, it's been this kind of cultural hub for Japanese Americans in the region, many of themselves who belong to these farming families, and people would grow up and visit their working gardens, and there's beautiful orchards, and they come and remember how long Japanese migrants have been part of California agricultural history. It's a long time.
All of these accounts in this article that you wrote are accompanied by images from Katsu Naito, who photographed the women in their homes, their businesses, sanctuaries. He was inspired by a Japanese saying, quote, "Do not step into someone's heart without taking shoes off," unquote. Do you have a favorite photograph from the series?
I think Katsu's photo of this woman, Lila Sasaki, who is kneeling at a gravestone, is my favorite photo. It's a memorial grave of Oke Ito, who is the one single woman who came over with the Wakamatsu colony, and she was a servant, and she is buried there, and she is the first known woman of Japanese descent buried on American soil. And Lila wasn't part of the group of women that we had brought together at Wakamatsu to be photographed by Katsu. She came with a friend. And it was sort of this magical, serendipitous moment. She gave us a letter that described coming to the gravesite as a child and sneaking on the gravesite and leaving flowers, which is just such a light-hearted but also deeply emotional anecdote that goes along with this photograph. To me, it captures what the whole story tries to show, which is how these wounds go so deep, but that healing is also a process that occurs over generations, and that these generations draw strength from each other.
Thank you so much, Bridget.
Sure.
I've been speaking with Bridget Reed about the survivors of the Japanese-American internment. To read her Vogue article called "The Memory Keepers," visit kcrw.com/goodfood. Time for a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, and here is Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Happy to be talking today with Tim Hollingsworth, who's a chef who's been active in the LA area for several years now. He's chef owner of Odium, which opened downtown next to the Broad Museum. And his most recent concept, his most recent restaurant, is kind of a sports bar. It is a sports bar.
It is.
Called Free Play, where you are also chef. And it's in the Fields Complex, right next to the Coliseum.
California Stadium.
Bank of California Stadium, yeah. So it's highly sports-centric.
Absolutely. LAFC plays there. The Rams are playing at the Coliseum, plus the Trojans, so very sports-centric, and when there's not local games, we're highlighting all the games on our mini TVs that we have.
Right, so you are literally next door to where the games are being played. You're not just a bar somewhere across town with some television sets. You are right there in the middle of the sports complex.
Yeah, I mean, you can literally enter into the Bank of California Stadium and watch LAFC play from the Fields or Free Play or CJ Boyd's.
That's fabulous. Okay, and so the concept is watching sports but eating fantastic food.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Northern California. I was actually just there this past weekend. We went to a restaurant called Lazy Dog. If we didn't go to Lazy Dog, which is kind of local up there, we would have gone to like a BJ's or something like that. So sort of these kind of sports bar, family-centric restaurants. And I wanted to open up something that resonated with my childhood and that ability to be able to watch sports. But I just wanted to elevate the food a little bit and be able to go in there and have something that's flavorful, it's good. You know, you can get healthy options as well as your sort of typical burgers and whatnot.
Okay, so talk about what you're here shopping for and what you're going to be. Tell us one of your dishes.
Yeah, so we're, you know, the spring menu is coming on. So now that we just hit spring, even though it's pouring down rain here in Santa Monica today.
We celebrate.
Which is great, right? But I think that, you know, we're going to be highlighting a taco that we're going to be doing. So we're going to be doing a tri-tip taco. Tri-tip being a very, like, Southern California meat. It's something that I grew up on. Being from a large family, we didn't have the money to get like ribeyes and whatnot, so we ate like a cheaper cut of meat, like a tri-tip. So I grew up barbecuing that from a very young age, and it's been one of my favorite cuts of meat since I was a child. And I think that we were going to be doing tri-tip tacos, and then you know, of course, seasonal salsa. The one I'd really like to highlight is our aji verde sauce. So the aji verde is something that is unique to being served on tacos. I don't really know anybody that does that, but it's a Peruvian sort of sauce that people put with grilled meats and whatnot. So I think right now with spring garlic being really in season, I think that using stuff like that, and then also other green vegetables, like we use the scallion tops, we use green garlic, just a lot of other ingredients to just highlight this sort of spicy, garlicky salsa.
Is aji, does that mean garlic in some language?
It does, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so like green garlic salsa.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is kind of your take on that traditional salsa?
It is, yeah. Uh-huh. It's pretty true to the exact thing, except for, you know, we sort of tweak it a little bit and make it more fitting towards a taco versus grilled meats and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's not really a typical thing for tacos, but like when we tried it and we thought about like, oh, what can we do and how can we make a taco different? LA has so many great tacos and, you know, you can go on the side of the street. Somebody could be making tacos. You go to a taco truck, you go to many, many different restaurants. And so we wanted to do something that wasn't typical and wasn't, you know, an al pastor taco or a ranchera taco or whatever, or lengua or whatever. We wanted to do something that was more in our vein, in our wheelhouse.
Yeah, it kind of combines your childhood memories too. It makes it more personal.
It does, yeah. You know, it does. And I think the flavor of the meat's really good. We marinate it like I grew up marinating that steak. So I think it's a really good dish, and I think that it's perfect for being able to go and have a beer cocktail and be able to watch the games.
That was Tim Hollingsworth, and he is chef at Free Play in the Fields right next to the Coliseum, and he's also executive chef at Odeum, which is next to the Broad Museum. Talking now with Noah Shaner, who's one of the many farmers here at the market who grows garlic. This is seasonal. It's now the spring or the green garlic. Noah, you actually have a head of garlic there that's just you could take home and plant as we speak. But you also have the green garlic, which has the long green stem on it and the not fully formed garlic head. What is the difference in age between this one with the cloves that are opening up and sprouting and then that green garlic you have sitting on the table that just looks like a giant scallion?
So the age difference would be about a month to 2 months.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah. And especially now that it's warming up, it's going to be growing a lot quicker. So all we do, too, is to plant to get to that stage is you just break off a little clove and you just plant it right in the ground. And then right there, when we come to harvest, we'll just pull the whole thing up for the green garlic and make our bunch.
Swamp.
Yeah.
Now, the green garlic you've got over there, it's about, what, about 18 inches, a foot to 18 inches tall. You pull that up. Are you thinning? Are you sort of going down the row and just kind of thinning it as you go? Or do you just pull it all up and you're done with that planting?
I look at the row, and if they're all good size, I'll just strip it. But most of the time I'm going through and I'm just picking out the bigger ones, leaving the smaller ones, because the smaller ones will still grow. Because I don't like giving garlic that's like smaller than your pinky.
Yeah.
Because there's not much, it's still flavorful, but there's not much to use with.
Now, what if a customer comes up and asks you, oh, what's the difference? Like, what should I get? I'm making a whatever. Are you able to kind of steer them as to if they want dry or green garlic?
I always, when I have green garlic, I steer them towards green garlic because I tell them, close down to the roots, you're going to get the really strong garlic flavor, and you use that just like garlic. And then the tops, I tell them you can use them like spring onions raw, throw them on salads, and you can even saute with the tops too. If they are still iffy, I'll be like, well, I only have this for a short time of the year. I have bulb garlic most of the year.
Yeah. So this is the green garlic season. You're going to be having it. We're now like getting to the end of March, early April. Are you going to have the green garlic, or are you letting it all bulb out starting now?
So we've been planting different fields and different sections. So we should have it till when it really starts getting warm. So it all depends on the weather. With how this winter has been, we probably will have it maybe end of May.
Are you finding it's becoming more and more popular, or more people asking for it?
Big time.
Yeah.
Before, people were scared of it. Yeah. Now, at this market and other markets, that's all they, when we have green garlic, that's all they want.
All right, Noah, well, you have a large farming family. You're down in Valley Center. You've been coming here for years. You're sort of like the next generation coming along. You're going to be the face of Shaner Farm for a while?
For a while, until I get one of my brothers back to help me out. So we got big shoes to fill in.
That was Noah Shaner. He is one of the Shaner kids. They have been a farming family down in Valley Center they're in their third generation now. And nice to see the young ones, the sons and daughters, coming home and helping out on the farm and growing delicious green garlic among many other items at their stand. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Coming up, a legendary sushi chef who recently made a much-anticipated return here in L.A. Stick around. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. The rise of L.A.'s sushi scene can be seen through the career of chef Morihiro Onodera, including his stints at Katsu, R23, Matsuhisa, and his own restaurant, Mori Sushi.
I grew up in a family that they make everything. They grew rice, and then they even made their own miso and then soy sauce.
Despite earning a Michelin star at Mori Sushi, Chef Mori left the sushi bar in 2011 for other creative pursuits. But now his fans can rejoice again. He's back making sushi at In-On, a tasting menu restaurant within the Japan House Cultural Center at Hollywood and Highland. Chef Mori Onodera joins me in the studio now with Tomoko Imade Dayan, the culinary curator of Japan House. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Arigatou gozaimasu.
Tomoko, why don't you tell us about Japan House?
So Japan House is a place you can go and then experience Japan through your five senses. There's an art gallery, which changes every 3 or 4 months. And we have a retail shop on the second floor of Hollywood and Highland. And then when you go to the fifth floor, there's a library. You can go through any books you want on Japan. And then there's an event space. Then there is an In-An restaurant where Mori works.
How long have you been working on this project, Mori?
I started November 26 at the In-An in Japan House. In the beginning, there was an opening chef I was just supporting. I started serving my own dish from January 8th.
And is it kaiseki style or is it traditional sushi bar?
I'm not sure if it's a kaiseki style, but it's a tasting menu. It starts from appetizers and then goes to seasonal tofu that I make. And then the next course is farmer's market vegetable, and then leads to sashimi and a grilled fish or meat, and then goes to fried food. Then after that, either meat or fish. The last is oshokuji, which usually is sushi. And then you can conclude dinner with, of course, dessert.
I'd love to know more about how you use aged vinegar. It seems to be coming back after falling out of favor with sushi eaters for a time. Is it used to season both the rice and the fish?
Hi.
Yes, I use aged vinegar. I use red aged vinegar. And then people in Japan used red aged vinegar almost 150 years ago. Since then, it's coming back in Japan as well. I use the aged vinegar as well as not aged red vinegar. So it's a combination of those two. And then I use that for fish as well as to rice.
Is the vinegar a rice-based vinegar?
Rice-based, hi.
Talk to me about your love for silver-skinned fish, for hikarimono.
Hikarimono.
I know that that it's a special fish. Are you getting all of this kind of fish from Japan?
Yes, I love it. I use sayori, kohada, saba, all from Japan.
So that's gizzard shad and mackerel.
Mackerel, hi.
It used to be that Americans had a hard time accepting these stronger flavored fishes. Have you noticed over the years that people are starting to love them as much as you do?
Yes, it's true that it used to be not as popular. But just about yesterday, one of the guests at the restaurant, he ordered sushi omakase menu, and then he wanted to eat more hikarimono, and then he loved kohada, and then he wanted to eat one more piece after eating 15 pieces of sushi. The fish the guest wanted was saba, the mackerel. So I think everybody is really, really into getting to know about the hikarimono. When I started Morizushi around 2000, you're right, not many people were into those fish. But nowadays, I think many Americans go to Japan, so they experience all those hikarimono and then what Japanese people eat. So if I prepare them well, it is getting really popular and many people request those.
I know that when you took your hiatus from the kitchen, when you stepped away and you had fallen in love with pottery and making your own dishes, which I think that the hand movements are so similar, that there's something very, very related between making pottery and cooking. When you come back to cooking and you're in a situation where you're really happy, what part of the making of the food gives you the most pleasure physically?
It's a very interesting question. Around 2012, I started making pottery. I always use knives on pottery as well. I started using it to make marks, make a design. So I realized that I really, really, really like using knives. So I don't know if it's anything related or influenced me, but my mother was a barber. I grew up around knives and then scissors. I see her sharpening her own tools. Even when I was 2 years old, I accidentally cut myself with knives, and then I was touching knives and then scissors. I don't know if it's related or influenced, but I always around knives.
So you're making right now, you're making three types of yuzu kosho, cherry blossom and matcha salt by hand, as well as your own tofu. How will guests at Inan see these used?
The
cherry blossom salt, I actually started to brine cherry blossom since last year. Last season's cherry blossom, I put in the salt, and then I made them dry. And then right now, we separate the flour and then salt and then grind them really, really well. And then I added more flour to it and then make sure that you sense the scent of the cherry blossom in cherry blossom salt. And then I use that with homemade tofu. And then as for matcha, I use the rock salt from Japan and then mix with the matcha and then use that with a tempura.
So Michelin announced that it's coming back to Southern California. Morisushi was one of a handful of restaurants to receive recognition a decade ago. What are your thoughts on having the inspectors back in Los Angeles?
It makes me nervous that they are coming back and then they are around. When I had a mori, I was very worried that if we can get it or not. Inan is still new and then I just started, so I'm not sure if we are the contender. But I think it's a great thing. I will make that goal to receive another star or two.
Famously, you've been involved in a rice partnership in Uruguay. At Inan, you're using Japanese rice, which isn't surprising. Can you talk about the kind of rice you're using and just speak a little bit about its importance to you?
I always think about what makes rice tasty. My first rice, I try to make everything from childhood come to life. So that's my goal. And then that's every day I think about what was the rice I ate as a child and how tasty it was.
It's stamped in my memory. Right now, I'm using short grain rice from Japan. Compared to American short grain and then Japanese grain, it's a tiny bit bigger. American short grain rice is about 0.08 millimeter. For Japanese grain, it's 0.09 millimeter. It's very slight, but I study every rice. So I think I want to say I know rice very well.
What variety is coming from Japan?
I'm using rice called Yume Hitachi from Ibaraki Prefecture in Japan. And when I was at the Mori, I blended two kinds of rice. One was Koshihikari for sushi, and the other one was called Yumegokochi, and then I used that for bento. And then Koshihikari that I used for sushi at Mori is less stickiness and then less amami, sweetness. And a Yumegokochi, because I served it in bento as a white rice, I used the Yumegokochi because it's a little stickier, it's a little more amami sweetness with it. And then right now, Yumehitachi that I use from Ibaraki Prefecture, it has good amount of stickiness and then a good amount of umami. And then it really, the texture in my mouth is really great. So I think it's really perfect for my sushi style right now.
Are you polishing it here?
When I started using Yumehitachi from Ibaraki Prefecture, it came as a brown rice, and then the factory here, they polished the rice. But lately, at the farms in Japan, they do everything, and then I get as fresh as possible. But I still have my rice polisher, and then I am planning to use that very, very soon.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to come visit us.
ありがとうございます.
Thank you so much.
That's sushi master Mori Onodera. We're lucky to have him back behind the sushi counter at Inon within Japan House. It's on the fifth floor of Hollywood and Highland, and reservations can be made on Open Table. On the topic of sushi, we now turn to LA Magazine food editor Garrett Snyder. He's always on the hunt for sushi that reminds him of his travels in Japan. Garrett recently visited one such place in Manhattan Beach, and I wanted to hear more. Hi, Garrett.
Hello.
So tell me where you went.
I went to this place called Sushi Inaba, which is an 8-seat sushi bar that's a couple blocks from the beach. And I first saw it because I was having brunch with some friends at Uncle Bill's Pancake House.
I love that place.
Yeah. Waiting in line, as you do on Sundays there. And across the street, I kind of saw this kind of minimally marked building, and I peeked my head in the window and saw this kind of beautiful wraparound wooden counter, and I was like, oh, it looks like a sushi counter. So it had only been open for maybe a year or two, but it was kind of a specialized omakase sushi counter that was really exciting to visit.
Tell me a bit about the chef, Yasu Hirano. What's his pedigree?
That's what really kind of blew my mind talking to him eating there is he actually hadn't really worked as a sushi chef before he kind of took over this spot. So he grew up in Chiba Prefecture, which is east of Tokyo. And he grew up the son of fishmongers, essentially. His dad was in the business. His mom ran a 200-seat sushi restaurant and also had a company that did exporting of fish, which in Japan takes a pretty specialized license. So he came to L.A. He had worked in restaurants for Inaba, the Inaba group, but he was always like a manager or front of house. And I don't think he was too involved in the kitchen usually, but I think he realized maybe it was too deep. Yeah. You know,
he couldn't avoid it. Since fish is so in his blood, where does he get the fish?
That's the really awesome part. And I think what stood out was he has direct access to these ports in Japan, which I think for most places here, even the really high-end sushi restaurants, they're going through an importing company, but he's able to kind of subvert that and get things airlifted directly from his mom's company, which sounds funny to say. But, you know, so he'll have fish that they're flown to him live in these big kind of like styrofoam tanks that have water filters on them. So just very special products, whether that's certain types of flounder, Japanese water snails, this certain type of really mature yellowtail called buri, which is it's where yellowtails have fattened up the most and they're caught and the meat's really exceptional. Octopus from Hokkaido that's really special.
What kind of sushi do they specialize in? Could you compare, for example, with maybe Mori Onodera sushi?
Mori, I think, is one of my favorite sushi chefs. I think he is influenced by what's called the Edomai style. The roots of it are in the Edo period of Japan, which was from, I think, 17th century, 16th century up to like the mid-1800s. And it was a boom time for Japan when Tokyo was this huge city that was blossoming. There were people that were selling this cured, preserved fish with vinegared rice. And that's really the roots of sushi. So I think chefs who look back at that and say that's what we're being influenced by, Mori took that as a leaping off point, but put his own kind of spin on it, which is very much part of him, you know, spending a lot of time in America and having his own taste as a chef. And I think you see a little bit of that in Yasu, where he knows the roots of Edo-style sushi. He knows kind of the rules, but he's also very comfortable sticking a toe beyond the line here and there because he knows the world already.
But he's an ager of fish.
That's the other thing that really stood out to me. Yeah, with Edo-style fish, it's traditionally aged. It's done basically like any kind of aging is done, in that you're trying to deepen, add another level of complexity to flavors. You're teasing out things that may have not been there before or heightening them. So, yeah, I think he kind of pushes it to the extreme a bit more. Some of the things he ages will go up to 3 weeks, which sounds kind of insane. But he's actually doing it in vacuum-packed plastic with a special paper that kind of helps absorb. He's doing it in ice water. So it's a very gentle process. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of similar to steak when you're aging, dry aging steak, because, you know, it will shrink a bit. He'll have to trim it eventually. So, you know, it's expensive in that way. You're basically wasting some of the product. So it was something that I had tried when I was in Japan. I was really fascinated by it. But to see someone kind of like pushing even further here was like really mind-blowing.
So give us an idea of the price point for dinner. I understand they also do lunch service.
Yeah. So dinner starts about, I think, $80 for about 12 pieces of sushi. You get this nice little miso soup with some clams in it, that he gets the clams from Japan. I think he was telling me that actually it was a type of clam that wasn't available for import until relatively recently. But so yeah, $80, that's pretty standard, I'd say, for that tier of sushi. And then it goes all the way up to $180, which is a certain type of omakase where you need 3 days notice, and he kind of brings out the big guns. So I didn't do that one. I did kind of the mid-tier one, which I think was like $120 or $150, and staggered out, scratching my head, because it was just a lot of things I hadn't seen before. At lunch, what's really awesome is he uses all the same fish. So he gets these deliveries from his mom. You can go in there and have a really shortened omakase with just the nigiri. That is about, I think, maybe 8 pieces, and it's like $30. And then he'll also do a chirashi bowl, where he just arranges different cuts of fish over rice, and that's probably like, I think, $30, $35. So I think it's great because you're getting the same experience, just getting a different format.
Well, thank you so much, Garrett.
Of course, anytime.
I've been talking with Garrett Snyder, food editor for LA Magazine, about sushi Inaba in Manhattan Beach. You can read his article about Inaba in the new issue of LA Magazine on newsstands now. After the break, we turn from fish to its fellow marine species, seaweed. My conversation with the women behind Salt Point Seaweed when we return. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. It's been referred to as the new kale, a superfood, and now it's floating onto restaurant menus everywhere. I'm talking about seaweed, namely the kind that's grown right here in California.
The species that we harvest are unique to California, so they are slightly different species than the ones in Asia. But we use the same word like kombu or nori because they're so similar.
The waters of Northern California are a treasure trove for edible local seaweeds, and three women have joined forces in an effort to harvest it for culinary use. I'm talking with two of them, Avery Rezor and Catherine O'Hare. Along with founder Tessa Emmer, they are Salt Point Seaweed. It's been referred to as the new kale and has been fashionably floating on to restaurant menus everywhere, perhaps as part of the new Nordic culinary influence as much as the Japanese. Seaweed may just be as much a superfood as blueberries, salmon, and chia seeds. A trio of Northern California women is taking to the sea to gather and distribute this vegetable from the ocean. Avery Rezor and Catherine O'Hare are two-thirds of Salt Point Seaweed. Hi, ladies.
Hello.
Hi.
Is kombu kelp?
Kombu is a type of kelp, yeah. So kelp refers to a group of brown seaweeds, brown algae. And kombu is from the family Laminaria, so it's a type of brown algae.
Does kombu also refer to the meatiness of it? I mean, when I think of kombu, let's say, as opposed to wakame, I think of something that is thicker and meatier, whereas wakame seems to be more lighter, thinner, more delicate.
That's a great observation. The California kombu that we harvest, which is Laminaria seychellii, is a thicker seaweed than the California wakame that we harvest. And that makes it especially good for cooking in dishes that need to cook for a long time. So things like soaking with beans or cooking with rice or in stews or broths or stocks. Kombu is really a delicious addition. Whereas wakame is better either blanched quickly and made into a nice salad or added later in the cooking process to soups.
You know, one of the things that really struck me as I was looking through your website is how in doing what you do, not only do you have to go through the whole process of foraging and processing, which I want to get into in a minute, but you also have to teach a lot of folks how to use the vegetables in a way that may be different from how they've thought about using them.
Yeah, that's definitely true. A big part of what we do is talking to people about seaweed, the way you can incorporate it into dishes that you already cook. And it's been true for us, too. Like, I didn't cook with seaweeds 10 years ago, but there are some that are really easy to incorporate. Like, kombu, I throw in any beans or grains or soup that I'm cooking. It is, you know, a unique thing to be bringing to our local community.
Yeah, because it's not, you're not just going to get kombu and make dashi from it. It's basically like salt. It's sea salt in a different form, a deeper form, right?
Yes, that's a great description. It adds that salt and has iodine, and in addition, it has the umami flavor, so the fifth flavor. And that just adds a special depth to stocks or soups that is hard to get elsewhere.
How did each of you find your way to the shoreline? Were you both like just ocean kids?
I grew up next to the ocean in Southern California and then was a biology major and worked on vegetable farms. So I've been interested in food, and then landing in the Bay Area and being close to this resource, it was kind of this connection for me that there's this local source of abundant seaweed that we can be using in our community and not importing from halfway around the world. So yeah, for me, it was kind of the intersection of food and health and local California.
And you're Catherine, yeah. Right?
Yes, this is Catherine.
This is Avery. For me, it was quite different. I was working and living in Tanzania, where there are a lot of women who farm seaweed, and they farm it primarily as a livelihood strategy and export it all around the globe. And so that was the first place that I was introduced to seaweed farming. And then I moved back to the States, to Berkeley, to go to grad school. And in grad school, met Tessa, who introduced me to Catherine. And together, they introduced me to this world of California seaweeds.
So when you talk about farming sea vegetables, do you literally have a part of the ocean sort of tied off that's yours? Is it an open resource? How does it work?
It's kind of like leasing land to graze cattle, for example. So the government, either if it's BLM or the Forest Service, owns the land, but leases it to a rancher who then runs his or her cattle on that land. But the land is still open. People can still go hiking and hunting and fishing on that land. So it's very similar for aquaculture in California. People can still boat around the land. They can still swim or fish. But in addition, there's a farmer who has leased it for aquaculture production.
It's just that you can't see it.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the trick about the ocean.
That makes it much more mysterious. So is part of what you do with the sea vegetables an intrinsic part of the oyster cycle?
part of our proof of concept is to measure how the seaweed grown on a lease shared with oysters affects the pH, the carbon, and the nitrogen around it. So there's scientists up and down the Pacific coast studying this and how seaweeds change and moderate pH locally. And that's especially important for shellfish production because ocean acidification is impacting shellfish yields. So we are studying that. A lot of more qualified people are also studying that. And we're trying to see if intercropping, essentially, so growing the shellfish and the seaweed together, could be beneficial for the shellfish.
After you collect the seaweed, after you harvest it, how is it processed for consumption?
We dry our seaweed in the sun primarily. So we do a solar drying system, and then some of our seaweed, we finish off by toasting it. We find that some seaweed varieties, when you toast them, it really brings out that umami and that almost nutty flavor. And we do that processing and any additional processing in a commercial kitchen in Oakland.
So what are the seasons for harvesting?
In California, in Northern California, we harvest in May through July. And that's just when we find that the seaweeds are healthiest and have the best flavor profile, and that we can harvest them in a sustainable way so they will grow back next year.
Well, I want to thank the two of you. This has been so interesting.
Thank you. We're happy to get to share this with people.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Avery Rezor and Catherine O'Hare. Along with Tessa Emmer, they're the female trio behind Salt Point Seaweed. You can learn more and browse their online shop at saltpointseaweed.com. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, you know what you can do. Listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, if you liked what you heard, please leave us a review. It is not too late to sign up for the 10th Annual Pie Contest. Even if you're not a baker, we hope you'll join us on April 28th for pie tastings, games, live music, and more. It's free to come. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Abby Swanson, Kenny Ng, and Laura Kondarajan. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.